This is the podcast for Wednesday, March 7th, 2012. Theory is knowledge. So we're talking about religious knowledge, and last time we left off talking about David Hume and his essay on miracles. And we talked about some criticisms of it, and one of them is that it seems to conflict with what Hume says elsewhere in his inquiry on human understanding. So all that stuff on cause and effect earlier on about the, you know, who knows what could happen. You could have a cause and it could be any number of effects. Whatever you could imagine might be the next effect. And then he takes, when you get to his thing where he's talking about religion and miracles, he seems to have a strong realist view on cause and effect. You think, well, what's going on there? Well, seems like he did the old switcheroo, and when it's convenient to him, he decides that the laws of nature have no violations, that they're absolute. Whereas earlier on, he says, well, who knows? You know, the laws of cause and effect, he says there is no such thing as cause and effect earlier on, and now he's saying, well, of course, the laws of cause and effect can't be violated, so a miracle can never occur. And so that, if you want to sum up the criticisms that can be made against Hume here, the criticisms of Hume on miracles, well, one is that it's circular reasoning. That he simply defines miracles out of existence. But his argument is deductively sound, but it's circular. So if you have a miracle is a violation of causal laws. Causal laws cannot be violated. Therefore, a miracle can never occur. Okay, this is like the definition, his definition of a miracle. Here, this is an interesting question about what his support for this is. This is one of his premises. But can you see how, if this is your definition of a miracle, and you're assuming this is part of the argument, this follows of necessity. It's deductively, it follows. It's like, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. But this really is sort of assumes that this is true. He's assuming in his premise what he draws from his conclusion. It's like saying, let's see if I can come up with an analogous case. Well, suppose you have an argument that, you know, the Bible is inspired by God. You say, you know, it says in 1 Timothy 3:16 or whatever, the Bible is inspired by God. Maybe an understood premise, everything the Bible says is true. Everything the Bible says is true. Therefore, the Bible is inspired by God. So what's wrong with his argument? Well, what if someone says, but how do you know that's true? And they say, well, of course everything in the Bible is true because it's inspired by God. Right? But that's what you're trying to prove, the Bible. How can you, you can't assume what you're trying to prove. You need to give evidence, evidence for why this thing is true, which doesn't involve already believing this thing is true. So this is a case of begging the question or circular reasoning. And it seems like Hume's doing the same sort of thing, except for the skeptic. He's saying, well, of course, we, you know, miracle's supposed to be a violation of the laws of nature. The laws of nature can never be violated, therefore a miracle can never occur. And so every time you say, well, how about this? How about this guy who had you know, cancer, and now he's in full remission after they prayed about him? Oh, well, it's obviously that he's not going to look at the evidence, right? You'd say, well, that would be a violation of the laws of nature. And we know a violation of the laws of nature is impossible, so it can't be a miracle. It must be some naturalistic explanation for it. And so it seems like no amount of evidence that you could put forward would prove, you could like have some person like in front of him and have you know, with like, who's missing like an arm, right? It's like, you know, no arm. And some clergyman comes in and says, oh God, please heal our brother here, and put his hand in the stump that where that guy's arm was, and it like grows, and the, and Hume would be standing there saying, nope, that's not a miracle, because we know the laws of nature have no, cannot be violated. That was a violation of laws of nature I just saw there. And so therefore, a miracle didn't occur. There has to be some other explanation for it. And so this seems like it's kind of a weak argument as stated. So there's a question about this, is what's, you know, why would you believe this? You know, what evidence is there? And so, if the evidence is, if the evidence for this is this, then it's circular reasoning. If the evidence for this, why believe this? Because you think this is true? You know, then it's circular reasoning. Why can't the laws of nature be violated? Well, because miracles don't happen. Why don't miracles happen? Because they're violation of the laws of nature, and there's no such thing. Right? It's a circular reasoning. Now, if you take this, there's another one, so it seems like taking it that way, it's circular reasoning. Now, how about, is there another way you might take the second premise instead of like a, just a statement of absolute fact? Or an assumption? How else might you take this? The law, causal laws can't be violated. Well, what if you just say there's no, you know, evidence that the laws of nature can be violated or something? Yeah.
Wouldn't that? How about the? I've never actually done research on them, but I have read a little bit about these vortex areas where, for one reason, unknown reason, the law of nature don't seem to operate according to the way you're supposed to.
Like the Bermuda Triangle or something, where the compasses go around in a circle.
Yeah, I had a friend that went down to the Gold Hill Vortex, and he said, you know how you pour water out of a pitcher into a glass? Theoretically, that water's supposed to go down into a glass.
Uh-huh.
But he says in the vortex, you pour it and it goes up and you start to dissipate. It's weird.
That's an interesting claim. Now, I find myself skeptical that like someone would take a picture and pour the water down, and instead of going down, it would go up. Now, is that a justified belief, or is that is that reaction, is that justified or is that unjustified? Am I just like biased?
That's a pretty natural reaction.
No, but it's a natural reaction. The question is it rational or not?
Yes.
Yeah, and Jason, do you want to comment on that? Or
what I would offer was just a different way to look at it, is simply that it's not causal laws cannot be violated or natural laws can't be violated. It's just that there's a lack of understanding of the principles that actually govern that thing which is considered a miracle. the scientific view. It's not a miracle, we just don't understand the exact methodology of occurrence.
So you're saying there's some, that like a broad enough scientific view would be able to incorporate like strange phenomena. And either you might look at it really closely and say, oh, it doesn't really, you know, it didn't really happen that way. Here's the naturalistic explanation. Or and you might actually end up saying, well, here's what we thought were the laws of science, but really we have to broaden them out to include, you know, psychic vibrations or, you know, vortex effects or something like that. Yeah.
What about in the case of spontaneous inflection? Because it's one of those things that hasn't been proven because it hasn't had evidence. Nobody's been able to experience it, but nobody's ever been able to disprove it either.
That's so, real.
Yeah, but it's like, it hasn't really been proven because there's really not that much evidence, but most of the time in these cases, the person is alone. But nobody knows how these people just spontaneously combusted.
Well, there are cases of people who have burned who that we're not sure what the cause were that they burned. That doesn't mean there's something called spontaneous human combustion as some mysterious force. It just means that there's some mysterious cases of people who have been immolated for unknown reasons. So it's not like, oh, maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. We can't prove it. Can't disprove it. To prove that there's something supernatural going on there, you need to produce some evidence that it's something other than the normal ways that people catch on fire. Like,
but isn't that, in a way, a miracle?
Smoking a cigarette in your deceased chair or something. What's that?
That's a nasty miracle.
Isn't that a miracle in itself that, like, we can't prove evidence that people are spontaneously combusted?
Well, that's the question. Is a miracle something that you don't have the explanation for? Is that like the definition of the miracle? That which cannot be explained?
Well, it defies science, right? It defies nature's laws. Isn't that what you said it was?
Right, but how do we know that it violates nature's laws? I mean, there have been cases I've heard about. It's like spontaneous human combustion, and people talk about how mysterious it was, and you find out the person was like, you know, old and a smoker. And a chain smoker, and they burned to death in their easy chair, and you see there's, you know, in the rubble you clearly see an ashtray in the rubble next to the easy chair, and like, okay, that sort of seems like an easy explanation. Or, you know, the gas explosion, and there's all sorts of ways that you can burn your house down and catch on fire. Flame works in weird ways, so there's a bunch of people that want to chime in on spontaneous human combustion. I'll get Michael first, I think your hand was up for longer.
So there's actually a Scottish professor and anatomist that has proven that spontaneous human combustion is a feasible and natural death. From what I understand, it's a chemical reaction that happens in your body, and the reason it perpetuates is because of the wicking effect. The wicking effect is basically you have, imagine a candle, how its wax perpetuates the fire. Same thing with the human body, but instead of wax, it's human fat that perpetuates the combustion, and that's how people will continue to burn.
So do thin people ever spontaneously combust?
Yes, we're back to the proven cases.
How does the temperature rise to that level?
That's like a huge, it is pretty large.
Somebody combust before? Like, is this something that has been witnessed? Like, somebody has watched somebody just like
a chemical. They can't prove that it happened. Yeah. They weren't taking photographs. Like, there's no actual film footage ever.
There are people saying that they're seeing.
Prove it or disprove it unless there's actual scientific evidence.
But Michael's explanation, though, it's not really a miracle. There's a scientific explanation for it.
Which is essentially what he was saying, is that all these things that we might call supernatural or miracles, there's actually an explanation for it, but we just don't know it yet because science is continually expanding. So
the question is, maybe does it fit in with known scientific laws, or would we have to change known science in order to account for it? Might be like a distinction. So will it fit in with our current paradigm, or, you know, is science going to have to include stuff about souls and energies and vibrations and lots of other stuff that you know, mainstream scientists don't believe in? Yeah, you had your hand up.
Well, I was just going to say, who's to say that God would work within his own laws to create things to happen.
Well, if you have a, so if you have God, you know, causing it, so I know, like, how would that happen? Like, God might bring about an event through that, that's sort of perfectly timed or something. I'm thinking about how that worked, like the parting of the Red Sea. If the parting of the Red Sea actually happened, and it was due to like air and wind currents, or something like that, and God caused that to happen, it wouldn't be a violation? It would have happened unless God did it. So the question is, how did God? What does it mean to say God did it? That it occurred right at the perfect moment or something?
I mean, even if we could explain it away, and it's still highly unusual, who's to say that since he, you know, if you believe that he's the creator of everything and the laws of nature, who's to say that he didn't do it through that still? Even if you can explain it away through the laws of nature, mm-hmm. who's to say that he didn't put that in motion? If he created the laws of nature to begin with.
Right. So it wouldn't be, maybe there's a question about what a violation of the laws of nature would be. Like, if God turned water into wine through altering the chemical composition of the wine, and like he stripped out all the atoms except for the hydrogen and oxygen ones, would that be a miracle? I mean, God would still be working within the frame of atomic physics. It's just that he'd be monkeying around with it. I think the supernatural aspect is that water doesn't turn to wine without some cause, and having that happen, with the cause being, you know, some person wills it to be is different, or God, you know, God willing it to be is different. That we don't see normal in the normal cause effect relationships. We don't know anything that could turn water into wine like that.
And this is kind of on the water to wine thing a little bit, somewhat. But there's some Japanese scientists that did experiments with water. I'm sure you've heard about that. And they want to put it under microscopes and show that the crystallization of the water was, the patterns were more beautiful when you had this water that had like good words written on it, you know, and like the bad words had all these, you know, erratic, you know, ugly, quote unquote, patterns on them. So that's something that they've actually done, like real scientific studies have proved. But what does that really prove? I mean, does that prove that like you're praying or, you know, making water holy water, or is it like what does it do?
See, to play him for a minute, I would be skeptical. I mean, I would say that hasn't been proven. It, the only place I've seen it is in kind of a New Agey video that has a lot of questionable claims in it.
Okay.
About what. And you don't find, the thing is, you don't find this stuff in like, you know, the
scientific journal.
Yeah, you find it like some sort of fringe person doing this research that can't, it's not a peer-reviewed journal. And there aren't independent observers. So I mean, that's typically if it were scientific,
it'd be more of a mainstream news story is what you're saying. In other words, like,
yeah,
you know, people would be like, wow, you can pray on water and it, you know, makes it better for you or whatever, you know.
Yeah, and I suppose you might say, well, they're just biased against Buddhists or something. But Michael.
So the scientist you're speaking of is Masaru Iwamoto. He's a Japanese scientist who's been studying water for the last 20 years, and has got documented evidence of how intention and words restructure the water molecule while it's crystallizing under a frozen temperature. With this said, there's also a science under the name of cymatics. Cymatics is how auditory and sub-auditory vibrational rates restructure matter. With this in mind, with the correct mantra, a phrase that's repetitively said, you can restructure form.
Because of vibration, but it's...
Yeah.
So I knew somebody had heard of that.
So with this in mind, though, this still is a miracle. This is a science that is just not known to laymen. You know, it's something that's, please excuse the term, it's an esoteric science, mm-hmm. which is just, it's a mystery science. It's something that up until this era of life, we haven't had sophisticated enough equipment to measure these effects.
Now, maybe the question is like, what is what is science? I guess, like if I down at my church, if I pray over someone and they're healed, is that a scientific verified? And suppose like there's evidence the person's healed, would you say that would be a miracle, or would you say, oh no, that's just like that's the science of healing? Like the Christian Science people call it the science of healing. They call it Christian Science, right? And what is Christian Science? It's don't go to the doctor, come in and we'll pray for you and you'll be healed. So there might be a question about the definition of science. I'd say like part of whether something's been scientifically verified is if it's first if you do follow the scientific method, and the second if you have your experiments been reproduced or appeared in peer-reviewed periodicals. And I'd say that even if the Yamamoto guy passed the first test, I don't think he's passed the second test or third test. So, and then the vibrational stuff, I'm skeptical. I've seen the claims, but I haven't seen really good evidence that it's the case. Yeah.
So would I just post that to a forum post, the evidence of this?
Sure, I'd be happy to look at it.
Okay, because...
Yeah, post the forum.
This is pretty phenomenal stuff. Like,
what I see it, I think I saw it in The Secret or something.
Well,
there
was, that's just a means of explaining how positive affirmations can change your outlook on life.
That's totally though. Well, I mean, that's explainable in simple psychological terms. You feel good, and then you have positive beliefs, and you'll take positive actions. Nobody disputes that would be the case. But the idea that you can change the molecular structure of matter by thinking good thoughts or by chanting, I think, is much more speculative. Let's see, is somebody else? Jason?
All of this just seems to remind me, I think it was Arthur C. Clarke that said, any science that is sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
Right, I quoted that last time.
I mean, that's really what it boils down to, right? I mean, eventually we might understand everything that was perceived as a miracle at one time as something that's a reproducible reality. Maybe not. Maybe at some point we'll shake hands with God.
Yeah, so maybe it all comes down to methodology. Let's see, what else is this? So,
coming back to Hume here, circular reasoning is one criticism. Why I believe that this second premise is true, is, and one way of looking at this is causal laws can't be violated a priori, in which case it's circular, or a posteriori, in which case it might be weak.
So if you say it's an a priori claim, it's just something that you just know without doing any investigation. Causal laws are causal laws. They can't be violated. Otherwise, it wouldn't be causal laws. If you say it's absolutely true, and despite whatever experience you might have, causal laws cannot be violated. If they are violated, you got the wrong causal laws. Then it seems like it's a circular argument. But if you say, okay, if it's an a posteriori claim, that means that it's based on some evidence. And so what that says is that... there's never been any evidence that the laws of nature have been violated, or if there is, it's really weak. But I think this argument here would be weak because people report miracles all the time. So now I suppose you might say, put a little question mark here. At least it's a weaker conclusion, but it's maybe a stronger argument. So you could say, look, do people levitate, right? You see David Blaine, and you see him, first he turns his back on you, and he puts his arms like this, and he goes up about like this far off the ground, right?
It's got to be real.
Yeah,
it's got to be.
He's like, oh, I don't know if I can get up. And he's like, oh, And so, but you know, like, you look at something like that, and like you think it's a trick, right? I mean, most people, although, but sometimes they'll get people on video and they think that he really is using some supernatural force. But most people think it's a trick. And why do they think that? Well, it's because you don't see people. You never seen a person levitate. And the normal course of events, all your background beliefs about gravity, about what causes an object to rise, all your sensory experiences, every time you've picked an object up, every time you've dropped an object, all the time you've felt something be heavy, and then your experience with things like balloons and airplanes and all, you know, watching birds, and all your experiences about what causes things to fall to earth and what causes them to come to the ground, and then maybe even your theoretical understanding of space, right, and the vacuum of space, and how if you're out in space and you're outside of gravity, well, you're just kind of floating around there, right? Or if you're in the water, right, you're buoyant, you're floating up on the surface. If you're too heavy, you sink. And so all these things make you think, all those laws of nature tell you that a person can't just float up into the air like that without having like some airlift and some lift from wings, from aerodynamic lift, without having a heavier than air or a lighter than air object like a balloon that's really, really big that he's holding. Or, you know, there's got to be you're looking for some gizmo, some means through which he's lifting himself. So that's why this is why. The idea that the laws of nature can't be violated has some plausibility if you just appeal to all the evidence of all your experience. And then what people will report things, right? And so they'll say, I was like out in the woods with my guru, and we were all like meditating, and then we like took some peyote, and then like all of a sudden I look up, and my guru is like floating up there above the trees, and like I passed out and had a vision. Let me tell you about it, right? And so even though the person's giving you a report that they saw a person levitating, they're like, you know, in a altered state of consciousness. They have a lot invested in their beliefs. They're out in the middle of nowhere, there's no observers, there's no cameras, and it's just this person say so. And maybe this person is like a kind of excitable person given to flights of fancy in the first place, and they seem to lack incredulity. They seem to be a very credulous person. And so all those things put together, you think, well, I'll sort of discount, I think I'm going to discount this because it's kind of weak evidence. This person's testimony, you know, doesn't seem very strong. And the case, it's like, there's all sorts of other naturalistic explanations, like this person is given the flights of fancy, they're under the influence of drugs, and so on and so forth. Or, you know, maybe the guru did some kind of trick with some wires or something like that. And, you know, people, you know that people have done this before, so, and you've never seen a person levitate. So Hume would say the empirical evidence is that the laws of nature can't be violated. But then the question is, could they never be violated? Is this sort of like a preponderance of evidence claim, or is it an assumption that is sort of an absolute thing? Yeah.
Can I just play devil's advocate?
Sure.
What defines the law of nature? Like, what's our definition for it? Because wasn't once the laws of nature, isn't what we consider the laws of nature, like the laws of gravity and stuff like that? Like, I believe reading earlier on, we said that whatever was once a god for a certain thing became a law to an extent.
Well, like, I mean,
for
people...
our own explanation for a certain thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a question about whether you really call those the laws of nature or not. It depends, I suppose, what you mean laws of nature are. I think Hume thinks laws of nature is sort of like scientific laws. Now, you could say, oh, well, that's like the ancient science was that disease was caused by evil spirits. But I think Hume would say that's not really science, because an evil spirit isn't something that's part of your everyday empirical experience. It's a theory that you've put together when a person gets sick about the cause of the person's sickness, and you're positing some occult forces for which there isn't any empirical evidence. You know, some hidden, mysterious reason. So, in a way, like you're you're attributing consciousness to the cause of this person's illness when, you know, no consciousness is, there's no evidence that it's a conscious being causing the person to be sick, for example. Like, that's one reason why, like, you know, disease isn't really, I mean, the disease theory, the germ theory of disease isn't really like a modification of the evil spirit theory of disease. It's a completely different theory, saying it's not, you know, malevolent immaterial beings that cause people to be sick. It's, you know, these microbes, which are you know, chains of DNA and RNA, like viruses and bacteria that do it, at least, you know, in some cases.
Right, but once we figured out what it was, uh-huh, afterwards, then it became a law. You know what I mean? So isn't that pretty much just...
No, it was always a law. I think humans say it was always a law.
Right, right.
So it's just we just discovered it.
Exactly. And so, like, looking at it like that, couldn't anything be a law, technically, once we finally figure out what it is?
Uh-huh.
It could then become a law instead of just a superstition. You know what I mean?
Right. So
if you go along that method of thinking.
We can't recreate these things with miracles. That's the whole point, right? Like, if you could just...
Right.
Well, we couldn't before either.
Right. But
what if you could?
But now we have an explanation for it. Unlike before, like with germs and stuff like that, people just say, oh, well, this spirit or instead of whatever is causing this person, but now we know, oh, okay, well, it's germs. And so then it became a law instead of just this venom thing.
Yeah.
So...
Like, there could be, like, suppose, like, with these, why is it that some people can be resuscitated and other people can't? And why is it that, like, after you're dead a certain amount of period of time, you can't be resuscitated? And maybe there's a law that says, like, it's 3 hours and the soul goes off to the next realm. And someday we'll have a soul detector. And, you know, like, you know, beholding on Johnny while they're trying to, you know, get his heart started after he died in the frozen lake. And there'll be one guy who's, like, you know, doing the old CPR thing or whatever we have in the future to try to get Johnny to come back to life. And the other guy with the soul detector will hold his soul detector and he'll be going, it's like, nope, sorry, Johnny's soul's gone off to the next world. There's no use trying. The guys give up, right? Because the soul's gone. It's not going to come back. But the thing is, like, to have the idea of, you know, saying there could be a soul detector, if there's no empirical evidence for souls, then you have to go with what the empirical evidence is right now. And what we're able to verify right now. You can't say, well, maybe in the future it will turn out that, you know, whatever. I still think so. I mean, are you saying there wouldn't be a distinction between, like, religion and science then?
Well, yeah, and then...
Or between superstition,
like,
and science?
Yeah, so it's kind of like, you know, well, how far is too much? You know, like, how... With that mind frame, it's kind of like, well... This argument, this search for God and stuff like that, how is that ever going to happen if you're still going to be skeptical about it, having these ideas of, you know, there being the laws of nature? Just saying that there's a law of nature and thinking of it in that context, there is no room for God.
Well, what if God's sort of the author of the laws of nature?
Exactly. Well, and then that's another thing, too. So where is all this coming from? You know, would that... Would he be considered nature?
There is, like, this idea that God could be, you know, God's equivalent to the laws of nature. I'm not sure what that means.
And so what's the definition? And then from that point, what is the definition of nature? If there's the law of nature, what is nature? What is the definition of nature?
And nature is the natural world, and I suppose you'd have to say the natural, you know, material world as detected by the five senses. Say. Of course, this isn't going to help humans with his idealist assumptions. But say the world detectable by the five senses. So, and I see what you're getting at. There's this sort of ambiguity in what you mean by nature. Does nature include God? Let's say God is outside of nature. So you have the natural world. So the question is there, like, some spirit? Are there spiritual laws and forces in addition to all the things we know about, like, electromagnetism and you know, the gravity and the strong and weak nuclear forces. I mean, we can detect all these things, and we can see things in microscopes, and we can detect, you know, electromagnetic radiation. But nobody's got a soul detector, and you can't like see God in a telescope. It's not like you point your telescope up into the space and you're like, there's Jupiter. Oh, there's God coming through, right? It's not something you can observe with your senses.
Right.
Science and the laws of nature are all defined through what you can observe by the senses.
Exactly. So then it's kind of, then what does the individual decide of, well, am I going to put God in nature, or am I just going to leave him completely out there? You know what I mean? So is that, like, who's pulling the strings? Is it God pulling the strings, or is it this?
In other words, you're saying, is God following nature's laws also? Is God
playing the role of nature, or is it just the world outside of God that is nature?
Yeah.
It's either or.
So, I mean, one thing you could say is that God sort of set up the laws of nature, and he's outside of it, observing the whole thing. It has nothing to do with it. Or you could say that God, from time to time, intervenes and does things which violate the laws of nature. He does a miracle. He's the author of the laws of nature. If he wants to come in and break the rules, then there's no reason why he couldn't. He's an omnipotent being. He can do what he wants. So even though water doesn't normally turn to wine, God can say, water turn to wine, and it turns to wine. And the molecules rearrange themselves, and they basically go to his will. It doesn't seem like there's anything absurd about that. But then the question is there evidence that those sorts of things happen? And should you believe those reports in the same way you'd believe reports that your best friend who's a drunk got drunk last night, right? So if I know someone who's a drunk, and I know they drink alcohol habitually to excess, and they say, I got so drunk last night, I woke up, I didn't even know where I was, and I'd broken the window and crawled into this stranger's apartment. And they came home in the morning after a grave shift and called the police, and I spent the night in jail, right? I'd say, well, sorry that happened here. Sorry to hear that. And you know, why would I believe this person's report? Well, they've been arrested before for drunken behavior. They've told me about their alcoholic blackouts. They tend to be in trouble with the law. I know they drink. You know, all their personal history. This fits in with everything I know about this person. But if the person told me, oh yeah, miraculous story. Well, it could be a miracle. If the person said, I went looking for my alcohol that I hid in my house, and I always hide it in this one cabinet, and I went to the cabinet, and I know I bought that bottle last night. I opened the cabinet, and the bottle was still there, but it was empty. And that was the miracle I was praying for. I said, God, please deliver me from the demon of alcoholism. And lo and behold, I wanted to drink so badly, but when I saw the bottle was empty, I know that God had done a divine miracle and drained that whiskey bottle. And I didn't drink that night, and I haven't had a drop since. Praise Jesus. What would you think? Would you believe that report as much as the other report?
No.
Why not?
Probably
black guy. Well, there you go, right? That's what I would say. But why would you disbelieve the miracle report, though? That's what he experienced. Why would you be skeptical of the miracle report?
Because that's just not something that, you know, is Pavlovian conditioning.
Well, that's what Hume might say. The other Hume, the Hume from earlier in the inquiry.
Because common sense tells you that that's just something that doesn't happen on a normal basis without some type of explanation.
But you know what's common sense? It goes back to the laws of nature, right? What people call common sense is just what people experience every day.
Well, I could argue that Hume's first idea of cause and effect was the reason why the bottle was empty, because when I went into the cabinet, I thought it was full, but for whatever reason, 100 out of 99 times, or 99 out of 100 times, that'd be the case. But this one case just didn't happen. And so the bottle is empty because Hume says that, cause and effect doesn't happen.
Right. That seems equally as absurd. So the third, I just put this up here. It's inconsistent with the rest of the inquiry, or let's say previous, his previous statements. Statements, skeptical of cause and effect. So it's what he says there is inconsistent with his previous statements, skeptical of cause and effect. So, and last time I left off with this, and I'll come back to this idea that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And this is, I suppose, oops. I don't know if Carl Sagan was the first person to say this, but he's famous for saying it. This is sort of the theme of his book, The Demon-Haunted World, where he investigates some of these sort of paranormal things and different sort of fringe scientific theories. And this is the idea, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So, this doesn't mean that you should just dismiss out of hand when you report some miracles. I think you should, look at all the conditions, like what happens in my example, at a person who is a severe alcoholic reporting a miracle under, suspicious circumstances. But what if, like, a really sober-minded person, a person I know who is of great truth and veracity, tends to have a skeptical mindset, and they tell me, that they saw a ghost, and they did some digging in the records of their property, and unbeknownst to them, like, somebody had died in the house. And they said that, the person who died under these circumstances, and it turns out that they're, the specter that appeared to them had this characteristics of the person that died. Maybe you take that with a little more seriously than the guy who's, got all sorts of reasons why you shouldn't believe him. Now, Hume would say, if somebody tells you a ghost story, it doesn't matter how reliable a person they seem to be, there's got to be some other explanation. But maybe what you'd say is, that's really interesting. Why don't I, hang out at your house and I'll see if I can see the ghost too, right? And then see what happens. And that might, that might be, one way of going about it. But you'd say, I need something more than just your say-so, because people have subjective experiences about all kinds of things, that most people are skeptical of. And everybody's probably skeptical about some people's supernatural experiences. I mean, they don't disagree that the person had an experience, but they disagree with the interpretation of the experience. And because the things happen to people that are inconsistent, right? So a person has the Virgin Mary appears to them, and the Virgin Mary says, it's really important for you to pray the rosary and go to mass and worship Mary and me, Mary, and my son Jesus. So another person might have a vision where it's where they're told, organized religion is people groping for God but not really understanding. Dead ritual is meaningless. Going to church and mouthing the words and all these rituals and the worship of supernatural beings is on a lower plane of existence. If you will be perfect, you should say this mantra or whatever, right? And focus on the oneness of all things. And then maybe some other person might get a vision that tells them that all these Catholics will burn in hell forever and ever because they're a bunch of idolaters worshiping a woman, the mother of the Savior, who is just a human being, and all these the people they call saints who are just human beings, and bowing down before statues of them and so on. So, I mean, all those revelations can't be true, right? And some other person says that, Muhammad told them to go out and fight in the jihad, right? And then somebody else gets a vision that says, oh no, Allah is all about peace and love, and that's what Islam's all about, right? Maybe a Sufi or something. So all those things can't be true at once, right? They're describing the world differently. So it seems like even if you're generally not, even if you're not generally skeptical about miracles or think that miracles can never occur, you still have to sort of sort out which miracles you think are real miracles and which ones you think might be scams or flights of fancy or hallucinations and so on. Michael.
I don't understand why those all can't happen, or all those revelations can't be all in existence at one time. I mean, if you look at an analogy of a wheel, you've got the center hub and all the spokes attaching to the outer wheel, those are all happening at the same time. They're different perspectives of the same thing.
But it's not a different perspective to say you should pray the rosary and say our Hail Marys and all our fathers and go to Mass, and somebody else saying, oh no, the dead rituals of organized religions are worthless. And you can get people that have those different messages.
But that's not the same, just like a counterpoint to that one point that was made?
No, it's like A and not A. Like, follow this religion, don't follow any religion. Or people follow this religion, or everybody in this religion are going to hell, and God hates them. Or God says kill all the unbelievers, God says love all the unbelievers. Or God says all, I mean, the Sufi might get a message, all religions are equal. Like, he might get a message like that you're suggesting. But lots of people get messages that say that view is of the devil, right? So then you have one, they can't both be true.
It just seems like they're just opposite ends of the spectrum.
Okay, would you agree that they're either it's a matter of perspective, or they can't all be true, that one of those is true of the other? Or is that just a matter of perspective too?
I think that's going to be a matter of perspective. I mean, like, if you're on the top of a mountain, you're going to be able to see the entire valley. But if you're at the bottom of the valley, you can see the entire mountain.
So I just don't belabor this point, but like, we're having a disagreement, aren't we? Right? I'm saying A and you're saying B, and A, where A and B are mutually exclusive propositions. I'm saying that same thing is occurring with the person that says pray to Mary, and the person that says Catholics are in hell. No offense to Catholics, but people do get these visions. And often the visions contain content about members of other religions, about your attitude towards unbelievers, and some of them are kind of lovey-dovey and accept everyone, and some messages are, you know, gays are going to hell, unbelievers are going to hell, idolaters are going to hell, and so on. And not just like new Christians, but sometimes, you know, you'll even get, Hindus will have visions saying that actually, Hindus tend to get sort of positive messages about members of other religions. But they might get a message that says, it's important to go back to the socially stratified caste system where everybody has their place in society. Or those school children on that bus, they're going to be reincarnated to their next life, so don't worry about the fact that the bus of, like, pariahs went off into the river and nobody saved them because they were unclean. They got what they deserved for their sins in the past life. Right? They might get a message like that. Or whatever, right? I mean, people get all kinds of religious messages which conflict. They give contradictory messages. And this is one of the problems with religious experience, and talk about this.
I had this one quick question. Inquiry concerning human understanding after his views on cause and effect.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, because it's funny. I think it's funny to even, like, had this published, and knowing that he had the cause and effect stuff published, because it just...
Well, it's in the same book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's in the same book. It's like chapter 7 and chapter 13 or something.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just wondering about that.
It might be that he's making a distinction between the cause and effect is more sort of theoretical about what may be proved, and that maybe this is more sort of talking about what you should believe.
Yeah. Well, it's just when
it is funny.
Anything imaginable is possible, but it can't be a miracle.
Unless a miracle. Unless
yeah,
a miracle.
It's just like. Okay.
It reminds me of some like atheist debates between atheists and theists, and the theist like makes an argument, and the atheist isn't quite sure what to say, but he'll say something like, "Okay, but whatever. How did the universe got here? God didn't create it." And they're really adamant about that, even though they don't have an explanation about why the universe exists or how it got here. But they're certain that however the universe got here, God didn't create it. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to talk about religious experience. Let's go radical here. And okay. I think it's called stigmata. I think it's called that, where you get these sores on your palm of your hand and on your feet where, you know, Jesus was nailed to the cross. What do you say about that? Or the idea that your brain itself, let's go to Land of Fringe for a second, can actually cause injuries on you if you think about it hard enough without something actually doing something to you, or like a bruise on you, your brain can actually cause that to you. What would he say about that?
Well, Hume might say, well, look, you know, if somebody like is suddenly bleeding from the palms for no apparent reason, there's a couple explanations. One, the person wants a lot of attention. Have you ever met anybody that wants a lot of attention and made up a story that wasn't true? And then how would the person get it? Well, it seems like if you live in a religious culture, one way to get attention would be like to hide like a little sharp object, you know, kind of up your sleeve or something like that, or in pants pocket, and kind of cut yourself and go all of a sudden wave your hands like this so they don't. Yeah, or maybe like you hold your hand up like this while you're palming it, right? This is one of the magician's trick where you sort of divert attention while you're doing something else. And he would say, that fits in really well with your experience. But you've never seen like a person bleeding. You've never spontaneous blood, and you don't see people doing that every day. It's like a rare occurrence.
Yeah.
And it only happens amongst like, you know, Catholics. So the stigma is a Catholic thing. And usually it's not even something that's done in public.
It's kind of weird. It just happens there every time.
But it's not something that's done like in like large crowds. Usually it's like there's... And it's not like, and people can't do it at will, of course. So, you know, you could like observe empirically. It's not something you can turn on or off. It just happens spontaneously. So you can't press the person, well, produce the stigmata, hold your hands out and let me look while the blood comes out to make sure you're not faking it. And they'll say, oh, no, I can't. It's like I was reading this book lent to me called Many Lives, Many Masters. I'm just showing I'm an open-minded person. You know, I read the whole book. And to me, it was really interesting talking about this phenomena of hypnotic regression and people, you know, experiencing their past lives. And it's a great use for therapists as a therapeutic tool for getting people to escape phobias and personal problems. Once a person remembers some trauma in a past life, their phobia tends to melt away. Really interesting stuff. But then this person says, yeah, and you know, the person that I was hypnotizing, they started developing these psychic powers, and they said their father-in-law was skeptical, and so this person I'm hypnotizing, she took her father-in-law down to the racetrack and won a bunch of races and won a whole bunch of money, and then gave it away to a homeless person and said that I would be wrong for her to make as much money as she wanted that way, because you can't misuse your psychic gifts. And to me, that story wasn't believable, because I think, you know, first of all, it's all... Well, I mean, it's all hearsay, right? So it's like third-person hearsay, and it's about this person claimed that their father-in-law was skeptical and that they took them to the dog crack and through supernatural, you know, power were able to win a whole bunch of money. I was thinking, if I had psychic powers and I could go down to the racetrack and win a bunch of money, I'd be there until I had enough to retire on. But this woman, she's like working as a nurse. She's on her feet all day. But the people that claim these powers for some reason always seem totally uninterested in money and claim that it's morally wrong for them to misuse their gifts to make money. I mean, it's not like you gamble. You could do all sorts of things, right? You could, there's all sorts of things you could do if you had psychic powers where you could predict future events. You could play the stock market. Yeah, I mean, you could go into business. All those people will be millionaires, but they always say, oh, no, it's wrong to use these gifts to make money. It seems really convenient to me.
Yeah.
where was I going with this? So I was skeptical about that. That's why I say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Now, you know, James Randi, the amazing Randi, has a $1 million prize available to anybody who's able to demonstrate psychic powers under controlled lab conditions. And
nobody's been able to do it yet.
His conditions are pretty stringent, but if you really do have psychic powers and aren't able to like beat chance by 2% guessing what the card looks like or by cold reading people, you should be able to do it. Yeah.
He actually offered that to that Japanese doctor with the water.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
That guy also sells bottles of water for $35. That kind of without scientific evidence of. You know what I mean?
Okay, no raspberry sounds. Let's keep this. I want to keep this respectful here. So, yeah. So that might make you more skeptical. So if you think about what Hume would say, that there's always going to be some explanation which is going to be more plausible than the supernatural one. And if you look at each individual case, there's only going to be some natural explanation. You want to go to those first. And now Hume says, well, just look for the natural explanation. Don't bother with the supernatural one. But I think the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. You're not closed-minded. You're not saying it definitely could never be a miracle. What you're saying is, well, let's see, if it's a miracle, it's going to need more evidence than just a regular occurrence. And so this would be an example. I posted this in one of the forums. I can't remember if it was the online class or this one. Yeah, I think it might have been the online class. We'll share it here. So take, two statements like Caesar crossed the Rubicon, Julius Caesar, in the 46 BC. Right? And then take another statement. Jesus rose from the dead. Or you might say Jesus, a lot of things that floated up into the sky and disappeared behind a cloud.
What year was that?
Right?
12.
This would have been
12 AD.
29 AD.
29 AD.
Right. Actually, if you go on the biblical account, they got pinned down to the day because it's
Easter, right?
Pentecost, I think, that happens. Or thereabouts. So he died on Easter, but he's hung around for like 40 days or something like that afterwards, 40 or 50 days. So so the question is, should you be as skeptical as one or the other, or should you be more skeptical of the second two claims? They're both written in historical books that make references to people, places, and things that we know existed. We know that Galilee was an area in Judea. We know that Jesus of Nazareth was a Jewish prophet, faith healer, and exorcist that lived in the first century. We know that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. And we know this through independent accounts from Josephus, from Pliny. There's like several different independent verifications outside of the New Testament. But even the New Testament, right? It's just a record of the teachings, words, and deeds of Jesus. So the question is, and let's put another one here. I'm trying to think of a good example from like something like Greek mythology.
Hercules was half man, half god.
Hercules killed the Cretan bull, or something like that. Or what's his name? Theseus killed the Minotaur. He was a half man, half bull. Another bull here.
most people look at these and they're like, oh, that's, you know, that's mythology. You're kidding. This is like not something you can take seriously. But then, you know, so you have a half man, half bull, and you have like a, I guess a really strong a bull. You have a man who's half God, half man. Well, you know, Jesus is supposed to be, you know, to have a heavenly father and a mortal mother. Jesus rising from the dead, that seems as miraculous as you know, half man, half bull. That's probably even more out of, you know, you might see like there's like hybrid animals and stuff, but you've never seen maybe you've never seen a minotaur, but at least you can kind of imagine like a kind of a freak of nature, like you get like a calf that's born with two heads, or you have Siamese twins, and you have like a, if you put like a horse and a donkey together, you get a mule. So maybe in some way you could get like a half man, half bull. But floating up to heaven, you know, and so and rising from the dead seems like way outside of the laws of nature. So then the question is, when you're looking at these old accounts, how do you distinguish fact from fiction? Or should you be more skeptical of the passages which describe miracles?
And the walls of Jericho. Fell down.
You know, fell outward.
How the hell do you spell Jericho? Jericho. Okay. Fell outward.
Just when the trumpets blasted of the Israelites.
Yeah. That statement. Showed every plan to fire from the areas. With these accounts that happened, we can't prove because we weren't there to see it. If a miracle would have happened right now and we couldn't explain it, then what? Would you discount it as not happening because it happened in front of us and we saw it happen, but we couldn't explain it?
Well, I could say, like, you know, the coffee in my coffee cup turned to wine.
Miracle. God, do miracles. Try to convince me.
Nope, still coffee.
Right.
So, but if it was wine, I would say, wow, that's really weird. Now, it might be that, like, this was like a plot between, like, you and him, and while you were distracting me with, like, a philosophical point, he was over there, you know, replacing my coffee or something.
Right, but so then you're naturally inclined to be a skeptic of why that turned into wine.
Well, it would be like if I was like holding this cup in my hand and just like drinking, you know, periodically, and I took and I made some especially sarcastic comment about miracles and turning water into wine, and I took my next sip and it was wine. I think I would like say, oh, maybe miracles do happen. And I'd change the song I'm singing, I guess.
But wouldn't you still be skeptical though? Wouldn't you still ask yourself the question, how did this happen?
I would ask the question, how did it happen? I'd probably say, maybe God did it. He's trying to give me a message. And
then you would believe in a miracle if, in that sense.
Yeah, I'd probably say it was a miracle.
Good luck convincing us.
What's that? But then probably nobody would believe me. They'd say, oh, there's Bardo. That's a crazy story about the time his coffee turned to the wine. I think he's probably, you know, drinking that wine maybe a lot these days. I heard his brother was an alcoholic, right, or something.
Right, and so with that, you know, how would anyone really accept the miracle happening if everyone's just going to be a skeptic about it? Would everyone have to see it? Because even if you and I were to witness a miracle,
yeah,
right, and we were to go off and tell other people about it, then what? What is their proof? Oh, well, we can't prove it. We saw it happen.
Yeah.
You know, what's our word to them?
I would say there's a problem with testimony, right? Well, if you experience it yourself, you're more much less skeptical than if you're hearing it from somebody else. Because you know that other people can make up stories.
Exactly.
And they can pull your leg, or they might, like, you know, they might have, like, perceived something. You're not there to verify it. And they're telling you there's no way it could have been a trick. And you're like, well, what about this? What about that? And they tell you, well, you had to be there. And you go, well, you're right, I did have to be there.
So technically, you really can never prove.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between that and, like, if somebody tells you, Bill Burrows is a funny guy, right? If I say, hey, if you want to take an econ class, take Bill Burrows because he's a funny guy and he's a great teacher. Right?
you know, would I have reasons to lie to you? You know, it's hard to think of a reason why I would be dishonest. And yeah, I'm just telling you about like another instructor giving a referral. And if you know I haven't lied to you in the past and I seem to be an honest person, you just accept that as face value. But if I tell you that Bill Burroughs is an alien, then I think you're justified in being skeptical. Because that's an extraordinary claim, and I'd have to say, and here's a sample of his DNA. I yanked out a few of his hairs, and ran out of his office as he was screaming after me, and he tried to shoot me with his ray gun, but I dodged it and got away, and here I am, and I'm going to do a test, and and then I come back with a DNA test, and I have a scientist there from Stanford that's going to tell you, show you like the results of the test, and it's not human DNA. Yeah.
As far as like the comparisons that you're making up here in regard, I mean, personally, I feel like it's because of Pascal's wager that we feel like, for example, Jesus did such and such, like, because we're raised under, from when we're born under kind of Pascal's wager. I mean, yeah, for the most part, my family is religious, so, growing up, you kind of had this fear of God, so of course, you wrote these stories about Hercules, and you're told that they're fictitious, uh-huh. But then you read these other stories about Jesus, and you're told, if you don't believe him, you're going to go to hell, and of course, naturally, your instinct is like, oh, well, yeah, Jesus walked on water, and yeah, that's easy to believe, but then there's a Minotaur? Yeah, right. You know what I mean? Like, so subconsciously, Pascal's wager kicks in because your whole life you've been programmed to,
That might be true for some religious people. But I mean, there's other religious people who are raised as atheists or as nothing,
Those people would laugh at both statements, right? Because
not necessarily.
Really...
Those people actually, because they're not inoculated to religion when they're old, they get religion late in life and it sticks, as opposed to the people raised with it sometimes fall away from it.
But that's not like a living, what the term was, I guess, in the last...
Well, maybe in our culture, you make a good point, like in this sort of culture, it's seen as plausible, whereas mythologies, Greek mythologies, probably nobody's going to believe that. Although I guess like a neo-pagan guy in one of my other classes that believes in the Norse gods, so I don't know. Neo-paganism is back on the rise again. Sorry, you had your hand up for a while.
I was just wondering if a miracle is an occurrence or like a happening, how much evidence is needed to make it extraordinary? Because there's many witnesses to things that Jesus has done, but I don't, and it was recorded, but how many witnesses were there with the Minotaurs, and where was it written? Like, what defines it as actual evidence if it's just an occurrence in that moment of time?
Jesus is a lot more plausible, I think. You've got a great plausibility because it was written a short time after he died. There are a lot of people around, so as far as... But I'd say, compare that with Caesar crossed the Rubicon. There are a lot more witnesses. And you have, sort of institutional things going on. Like, you have the guy who's the emperor, and you have lots of court historians and people that are recording things. And so there's a lot more oversight than, a cult, a Jewish heresy that's being persecuted and sort of operating underground in the first century.
But when is it enough? When is it enough extraordinary evidence? If it's an occurrence that happened so long ago, how do you measure? Where's your graph on, this is enough evidence?
Everybody has to see.
It depends on the individual case, I think. But I think there's a difference between something that fits in with what we know, Caesar, an emperor doing something provocative and starting a war with his rival, as opposed to a person floating into heaven or raising dead or being rising from the dead himself and so on. So that's the main point about the extraordinary evidence. Although some religious people would argue the contrary case, and they'd say, well, look, I talk to God every day, and you look at how many people believe in God. Well, 90% of the U.S. population, higher in some countries, a little lower in others, but the majority of people believe in God and tell you they've had at least some religious experiences. So maybe it's the atheists who are the odd man out that are, and maybe it's not having any experiences of God, which is extraordinary.
You're going to be left behind.
So that's all we have time for now. I got to get to a committee meeting. So don't forget to post the forum before 11:55 p.m. Sunday. And I'll see you Monday to talk about moral and political knowledge.
Next week, the extra credit
exam opens Monday at 9:00.